This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about a long-standing connection between Evansville and Kenya and the learning center created because of it with two people who helped make it happen. We're live, so if you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we will do our best to get it into the conversation today. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Joining me on Skype is Lynn Rennie, pastor of Outreach Ministries and Missions at Aldersgate United Methodist Church. Hi, Lynn. And Peter Mageto Maiko is deputy vice chancellor at Africa University, calling in from Zimbabwe. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Matt. How are you?
I'm excellent. Well, Peter, let's start at the beginning of the story between you and Lynn. How did you first meet?
We first met at Evanston at the Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary. Lynn had put up an advert through the college, through the seminary that she was going to come in and visit some students undertaking ministry from Indiana Conference. And I had an interest to sign up to want to meet her to see any potential opportunity for me to be able to get an opening to serve in Indiana. And here she was. She said, yes, come through. You can meet with me. That's how we met.
What were you doing at that time, Peter? Why were you in the U.S.?
I was in the U.S. pursuing my graduate studies. I'd come over to Evanston to do my master's in theological studies. And I'd already enrolled in a doctor of philosophy in ethics. I'd completed coursework. And I was writing my dissertation. So I needed a place to be able to share them with my family as I wrote my dissertation. That's what I was doing.
And in that first meeting with Lynn, I don't know, what else did you talk about? What came up?
You know, when you meet for the first time, first I was interested to know who this was because I'd attempted to have meetings with three other people before and I had not managed. But yes, she was saying yes. So I was looking forward to meeting this lady who had said yes to meet with me. But interestingly, she wanted to know about me. She wanted to know about Kenya. She wanted to know about Africa. And if you meet Lynn, she's very jovial, very social, makes you very comfortable to settle down. And then she was really interested about me as a person and my family, and I felt encouraged in that first meeting.
Lynn, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. So, I mean, I understand you've learned a lot since then in the 17 years since this first meeting, but what did you learn that day when you first met Peter that you didn't know before in the initial conversation you had?
Well, actually, when I showed up, I was supposed to meet with five students who were from our conference in Indiana. It was a horribly cold day, and it was so tempting for me to just say, I'm going to forget it because it was really freezing. I just wanted to stay in with my daughter and my new grandchild. But I decided something said, just go to Garrett, just go. And actually, none of the five students showed up. The only one who showed up because it was so cold, they hadn't wanted to get out. But there was a name on the list, and it said Peter Mageto. And so I said, who is Peter Mageto? You know, he's not on our list from our conference. And they said, he just knew you were coming, and he wanted to come in and talk to you. And I said, okay, that's great. So I went in the room and sat down, and this man walked in. And he sat down in front of me and smiled. And I said, hello. And I said, do you remember Peter? I said, took your picture. I said, for our files. And not knowing what else to say, I just looked at him and smiled and simply said, tell me your story. And so what he told me was absolutely incredible. And what I learned, to answer your question that day, was that he had grown up in a tiny village in western Kenya. And his family practiced a tribal religion, with animal sacrifices back when he was a child in a village where there was no electricity or no water. And so as he was talking, I began to take notes on my yellow legal pad because I was so fascinated. It turns out that when he was a teenager, he went with friends to hear missionaries from Scotland. And after a short time, he became a Christian. His parents thought he was crazy. But actually, 6 years later, they became Christian, too. Peter went to training in Nairobi and founded a church under a tree as an 18-year-old. And we're now partnering with that church. And then he told me that his reason for coming to talk with me, like he told you, is that he and his family needed a place to live where he could serve as a student pastor and write his doctoral dissertation. The Illinois conference had turned him down. The Indiana conference had turned him down. But I said, I think we can do something. And so I brought his story back to our mission committee, and they said, bring him to Evansville. And so that's how that all happened. I bet you don't realize that I remembered all that.
I must congratulate you, Lynn. I remember your writing part, and you kept writing as I kept talking. I can't believe it. So 17 years ago, you still remember as if we met yesterday.
Yeah, for sure.
Peter, I loved hearing your laughter as she was recounting this, because it's so, I guess, illustrative of how much has happened since then, which we'll definitely get to in the conversation. But Peter, you went to Garrett Theological Seminary in 1998, which is just north of Chicago in Evanston. What was that experience like?
It was all a new experience, Matt. From my family, I was the first one to come from the village to Nairobi. From my family, I was the first one to get out of the country all the way to Chicago. And I came with my wife, and we had been impressed with our son, our firstborn. He was only 2 years old as we came to the U.S., It was a new experience. It was first of all, it was scary. We didn't know where we were going, but secondly, we were sure that we were headed in the right direction. So it was a new experience altogether, a new experience in the sense that we were coming to a different culture. We were coming to a developed first world country. We were coming also to pursue graduate studies, which I had not been involved in before. So it was all together an eye-opener for us and for me as a person.
Well, and another new experience was that you saw a library for the first time at Garrett Theological Seminary. What was that like?
That was scary. The first time during orientation, you are being taken around, and then you find the whole of this building that is full of books, and that time it was Garrett. I had not gone to Northwestern Africana Library just to find many volumes on anything published on Africa. Any topic, you will find it there. I looked around and I wondered. I said, oh my goodness, am I going to be required to read all this? And to me, that was a shock. And you may be surprised, Matt, that this led me to even want to be to do work study as a student at Cokesbury Bookstore, because I got to love books, because I had not had access to a book, to a textbook. So this was the first time. So between the library and the bookstore, I spent my 5 years in that place working as a work study student.
Well, let's go back to Kenya. When you were there, you went to primary school, high school, college, and you became an ordained United Methodist minister. Can you tell us what that education was like?
You know, it's for someone who has not gone through it, sometimes you listen to it, you wonder if it is true. But this is how you want to picture it. That you went to primary school and the only textbook that you had before you was your teacher. You went to high school. The only textbook you had was your teacher. So everything your teacher said and wrote on the board, you needed to get it. You needed to write it. You needed to ensure that you have gotten it correctly. And that's what happened all through to college. There were no moments of smartphones to record your lectures. There was no moment for you to download anything. The one in front of you was your library, was your textbook. So it was a total transformation of some type, but a very good experience. It helped you to not just memorize, but learn to critically ensure that you have the information that you need. But it also built, it enhanced relationships. It gave teachers and students an opportunity to build a very strong relationship, because you desired to hear and to learn more.
Lynn, we have about a minute left in this segment. I want to go back to that meeting, that first meeting with Peter. Was it obvious that something was going to come from that meeting? Did you have this feeling at the end of it that you were about to help do something big?
No, I really didn't have any idea. All I knew was that I was just incredibly impressed. But it wasn't going to be up to me. It would be up to our church to invite him down. And so I was filled with hope that they would pick up the dream just as I had picked it up. And I knew we had a vacant house by the church. So in many ways, it seemed like I think it'll happen. But I didn't know until I came back and brought it to the committee and the minister.
Well, we'll talk about what happened, of course, when we come back after a quick break. We'll be back with Peter and Lynn in just a little bit. And if you have questions or comments for our show today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. Or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're talking about a longstanding connection between Evansville and Kenya and the Learning Center that was created because of it. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 2 minutes. This is All In. All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about a learning center created in a Kenyan village and how a group of people in Evansville helped make it happen. And we would love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. And we are joined today by Lynn Rennie, pastor of Outreach Ministries and Missions at Aldersgate United Methodist Church. And Peter Magueto Maiko is deputy vice chancellor at Africa University. And he's calling in from Zimbabwe. So, Peter, when did the idea for the Imani Learning Center start forming in your head, I guess?
I was so moved by what I experienced up in Evanston as I watched students, specifically those from Northwestern, the Evanston campus, as they were coming to the end of each semester, as they were graduating in May, and they do not want to carry some of these books back home. You could find all this in the trash. And I decided there was one that was close to the hostel, so I decided to be picking some of the books and storing them in the basement. I asked that I be allowed to keep them in the basement as I was looking for ways and means to see how I can take them to Kenya. Here was a treasure. There was something here very, very rich that I had not seen before, and I was looking now for ways and possible means to see how I can take these books to Kenya. That's how the idea came. I started collecting the books and keeping them in the basement, the hostel, the apartment, the basement, hoping that one time I'll take them to Kenya. And that's how it all started.
And so that was in Evanston, Illinois.
That was in Evanston.
And so in Evansville, when you met with Lynn, how did things then progress after that meeting with Peter? I mean, you said you didn't have these big grand ideas at that first meeting, but it obviously continued. So how did the project take shape?
So our church said, bring him and his family to Evansville. And the Megettos moved here, and they became part of our church family for 3 years. Peter became a student pastor, led Bible studies and so forth. And one of the things he did was accept an invitation to speak at a local high school called the Signature School, which is in downtown Evansville. And he was just going to talk about HIV/AIDS, which was an important subject for him. It's what he was working on his dissertation on. And so during this talk with the students, he spoke about his life growing up in Kenya and mentioned that he never had a book. And he said that it was a dream of his that someday people would have a place to go and read. And so when four of those Signature School students from heard him, they were so inspired that they took that dream and ran with it. They said, he wants a library for his village. Hey, no problem. We'll build one. And so with the enthusiasm and probably the nonchalance of kids, they went ahead and they did it. They developed a strategy, and they had plans drawn up by an Aldersgate member who was with a local architectural firm. They raised money. They raised a total of, I think, $35,000 plus. And that's how it started. And life for many of us has never been the same since.
Peter, then, can you tell us what the Amani Learning Center is exactly now that it's there and now that the idea has kind of fully formed and it's taken shape? What would we see there if we visited?
It is one of those places you literally want to go and get excited when you find all these young people from little children, grade one, all the way to university, entering into this place, and they could be seated there in the room pulling a book, a novel, a storybook to read, and getting someone to give them advice as they read along. This is the place where literally a number of almost seven schools around this village, children, young, and those in university come in and learn. And now with the computer center there, you can imagine that an email can be opened there, and much more is on the way coming. So it is a place where literally the whole community knows that something has come through and has transformed their lives. I am so excited, Matt, to tell you the truth, that the dream I had has come to be true, where children walked. Even as we speak now, it is the only library in my county. Only library in my county. I am so glad that Lynn and those who have worked together, they have brought this to be a bigger reality than even I thought about. So it's always exciting.
Well, that was going to be my next question, Peter. Would you say that that what has come to be exceeded your expectations or exceeded your, I guess, dreams for a facility like this? Did you do better than you had hoped?
It went beyond my dream, to tell you, Matt. And I hope that generations to come will look back, and of course they will have realized that the libraries are now open source. They are now with e-resources. I am hopeful that as times change, the Amani Learning Center will also keep changing. For sure, it went beyond my imagination. That's not what I thought. What I thought at the beginning has gone beyond my imagination.
Lynn, so you met with these students at Signature School, and this is kind of how it began to take shape. And, As so many people who have dreams and try to build on those dreams find out, execution is one thing, dreaming it is entirely another. And it sounds like you were really able to come through and give Peter and his community exactly what they needed. What had to come next after the Signature School students sort of dreamt this up? How did you actually execute it?
You mean the building of it or the running of it? Or
building of it is its own initial challenge, I guess.
Yeah, and the building, the thing that I really like about the building process was that it was done by local Kenyans. So mm-hmm. it wasn't something that we traveled there and then we Americans went and built. You know, the money went for the local craftsmen to do what they do well. They knew how to do it, and they did the building on their own. And so we could watch it happen with pictures, and then we all went after it was finished, and 11 of us went and did the grand opening, the inauguration. That was so exciting.
You were among that group, right, Lynn?
I was, yeah.
And you've been there quite a bit, made a few trips to Kenya since this started.
Yeah, last summer was my 19th trip.
And
if you had told me in the beginning that that would be the case, I would have said you're crazy. I had no intention of ever becoming an international missionary. And so this has all been a real surprise to me too.
Well, what's your experience been like visiting the village and meeting the people there? What have you been able to do, I guess, by going there?
I've been able to develop friendships that have lasted all the trips. They become family to me. When I pull up at the gate, I feel like I'm at my second home. I'm very familiar with the culture now and the people, and I'm doing my best to learn Swahili and Kisi language, tribal language.
Yes.
Peter, can you describe the community there and what the village is like?
One of the things that we take note is that Kenya as a country has almost 47 different ethnic groups. And within the village where the learning center is known as Kisi. This is a rural village. There's nothing that you want to compare it with anywhere in the U.S. In the village, you need to know that you do not have all these tarmac roads. Electricity was never available. It is now being accessed. There's no tap water, so people fetch water from the rivers, even as we speak now. You need to know that there is no gas, so people do not use gas to cook. People use firewood. They gather firewood to cook as we speak now. This is the kind of village we are talking about where this library is.
So this library and computer lab was, it sounds like certainly an upgrade at the village, but is there anything else at the Amani Center other than that library and the computer lab?
As we speak now, there is a progressive plan, because one of the things Lynn has done with the teams she brings to Kenya, they do not come to see animals. They come to work. They do not come to just to see the cultures. They come to work. Every trip that Lynn has led to Kenya has been a medical trip. We hold medical camps where free medications are given. And to tell you, Matt, and the listeners, this has been a major, major impact in the village. People travel for hours. People walk for 4 to 5 hours just to come for a free medical camp. And interestingly, God has been gracious, Lynn and our teams that have come, they have come with medicines. And these medicines, interestingly, Matt, and listeners, work miracles. People get well. And as they get well, they talk about the Amani Learning Center. And anytime they are talking about the Amani Learning Center, they're asking, when are the guests coming again? So what has happened, Matt and listeners, is that there has now emerged a plan to develop a medical center, a place where subsidized health care will be given. And Lynn has been very keen. She has been part of the team that she has around her to get this going. So this is a new development altogether. So from the learning, apart from coming in to learn, there will be an opportunity for you to come in and be checked if your health is good.
I might add that in my first life, I was an RN. And so part of me looked at the learning center and said, what else can we do here to help the people in the village? And I said, maybe we could do a medical camp. And so we tried that out. And so that was my nursing experience, bringing the medical piece of it to the village.
Peter, let's look at some more big picture stuff. How would you describe the state of education in Kenya right now? Is it changing?
The state of education is changing, but the access to resources for education is not changing. And to me, that's the greatest worry that I see. You can tell that we talk about access to education. Everyone is supposed to get to school. There's free education from grade 1 to grade 8. But that does not mean that resources are available. It is very disappointing, I can say, without fear or contradiction, that indeed, still we have places in Kenya where students and children who go to school are not accessing resources. And I mean learning resources. So sometimes within context where people talk about, oh, our students do not have Wi-Fi, our students do not have computers. Those are luxuries. In many parts in Kenya, we still have places where education is being mentioned, but the educational resources are minimal. They might not even be available.
So would you say access to those resources is the most important change needed to help make education better, or should it go even further than that?
Okay. For sure. I think making those basic resources available, you know, Matt, if you grew up in a culture where you didn't know that someone went to school and had access, then all of a sudden you find that you can have access. I count the Aman Learning Center as a privileged community of those schools around there because they can access books. And by the way, it is good to mention that these are not historical books. They are not classics. What Lynn and her team have continued to do is to provide also resources that are up to date, resources that go according to the curriculum of the country. So when children are going to the library, they are current to the curriculum of the country, of education of the country.
And Lynn, so much of this is thanks to the generosity of people in the Evansville area. Just how much has it cost to put this together?
Well, it's gosh, that's a good question. Just for the trips themselves, it takes each of the team members pays for themselves. And it probably costs about $5,000 to put on a medical camp, because not only do we bring them the medicine, but we hire local people to serve the area. So we pay a salary, a stipend to, say, a dentist, a local dentist, the local nurses and clinicians, lab technicians, and so forth, so that they have a salary. It's not just us coming in and doing it for them. So it's probably, you know, it'll take $5,000 for each medical camp, plus the travel and plus the upkeep. We pay for a librarian each year and a security man each year. And people have just been so generous in supporting this project through the years. It's been quite awesome.
Lynn, what would you say you've learned from this whole experience?
I think for me, it's just when you see a wave that is encouraging and exciting and it seems like it has possibilities and ignites your passion, just hop on it and have fun, because you never know where it's going to lead you.
Peter, in our last minute, what are your goals for the center now? Do you want to expand it, maybe create new centers in other communities?
That's my hope and that's my plan, even when I'm in Zimbabwe. That keeps to be my ideas. I link with the people in the village and those who continue to run the center. Our desire is to replicate such centers in the communities that really and that are in need of such kind of centers. So we hope that this will be a model of an excellency center, and we hope that even government in our country will also pick it and see how they can try to replicate it in other areas. So that's my dream.
Well, it's such a great story, and I'm so glad that you both joined us today to talk about it on our show. I want to thank you both. Lynn Rennie is pastor of Outreach Ministries and Missions at Aldersgate United Methodist Church. Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you.
And Peter Mageto Maiko is deputy vice chancellor at Africa University. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you for having me.
And if you want to learn more about this story, our NPR affiliate in Evansville, WNIN, is doing a full series on it called The Amani Connection. You can find it on news.wnin.org. And up next, we're going to talk with WFYI's education reporter Eric Weddle to find out why Indianapolis Public Schools did not follow through with plans to review its own police force. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. In our last segment today, we're switching gears to talk about IPS, that's Indianapolis Public Schools, and the news that the district did not complete a review of its police force after announcing it 4 years ago. To learn more about this, we're talking to Eric Weddle, education reporter for our flagship station, WFYI. Thanks for taking the time, Eric.
Yeah, no problem.
And so what exactly did IPS announce they were going to do in 2016?
Sure. So back then, back in 2015 or so, they created a strategic plan. And part of that was a review of their police force to kind of try and bring in best practices, increase transparency and accountability. And as part of that, they got a hold of Indiana University's Public Policy Center and asked them to do a review of the force, kind of like an analysis. And They provided data and answered questions that the researchers wanted, and then they put out a report kind of just, you know, analyzing the data and making some recommendations to the district in March 2016 that was made public by IPS. And they said there's some good things here. They told the school board this at a public meeting, and then they said they were going to review this and kind of act on it. And it turns out that that did not happen.
What was the reason they gave for planning to do it at that time?
Of not doing it?
I suppose, yeah, sure.
Well, they actually never said they didn't do it. So it just kind of faded away. It was never discussed publicly, as far as I'm aware. And so when I reached out to the district recently to kind of follow up on it, they basically said, you know, a lot of things happened at that time. Elections with the school board happened. Administrators changed. The superintendent at the time left in December of 2018. Last year, the police chief retired. So there are a lot of things that they said were the reason for, even though those things kind of happened quite a while after that report was actually released.
Could a review like this have any direct impact on things?
Well, I think, you know, it kind of gave the district some ideas. You know, the report, which is on the WFI website, we have a link to it. You know, it basically points out, you know, this police force is following a lot of best practices. You know, they have lots of experience in these officers. And from what the researchers found was they seemed to be doing, you know, a good job. But they did find, you know, that there could be improvements to the data, how it's collected. A lot of what the officers are doing on a daily basis really isn't being categorized. The researchers felt that, you know, and without that categorization, it's hard to kind of say what is working, what's not working, what are people spending their time on. And one of the big issues they brought up, which we're kind of seeing right now play out in protests in the street, it was a recommendation for more accountability. And so they had recommended that there be a very transparent or maybe even a citizens review panel for officers who face any kind of complaint from a student or the public, which currently does not exist at the district.
So what is this police force? I think a lot of people might not know what school district police forces are even really like and how that's structured.
Sure, that's a great question. A lot of school districts in Indiana and across the country do not have a police force. They partner with the local police department, who maybe provides different kinds of resources. Some schools may have security guards. School resource officer is a name that we hear a lot. So it really depends on the school district and what they are providing. IPS, the Indianapolis Public School District, they are, that I'm aware, I think now one of 8 districts in the state that has a police force. So there's actually a law enforcement agency that is part of the school district that's not part of the local city or county police. And, you know, they have, you know, all of the kind of authority and legal authority as a police officer does. So in their job, you know, they can't arrest people, you know, in the job. They can take people to jail. And then a lot now we're seeing is, you know, they're doing a lot of times of mentoring and other kinds of services in schools.
All right. And so this review was shelved. And have the leaders said anything about new plans to conduct this review?
Sure. You know, so as we've seen, you know, in the past month, you know, the protests that are in the streets, you know, around racial justice, that those protests are turning to schools in some cities. So some cities right now have already voted to actually sever relationships with local police departments that happened in Minneapolis. Los Angeles School District just voted to cut $25 million from its school police force budget. So these conversations are happening in cities throughout the country. In Indianapolis, that really has not happened yet, but the superintendent, Alicia Johnson, has kind of come out and said, we hear this, we know we need to look into this, and we're going to be doing some kind of review of the police force.
The reason behind that, I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of reasons, but I mean, does it seem like, from your perspective in reporting on this, does it seem like their presence seems for some people to be just causing more problems than what it might be solving or preventing?
Yeah, I think there, you know, people have different reasons. You know, I think one of the biggest ones, you know, is the school to prison pipeline, where minority students, students of color, students with disabilities often see a higher portion of them facing law enforcement in schools, being arrested, and then kind of getting into that system, whether it's a juvenile system or the adult system. And so I think that is the concern from a lot of people. They'd rather have school counselors, teachers, other people kind of dealing with these problems before law enforcement can get involved. And then things can kind of, you know, get out of control, and possibly, you know, students, instead of facing discipline in the schools, now are facing discipline in the courtroom.
This is more of a general question along those lines, and I'm curious, in your time as an education reporter, have you found that school district police forces get much scrutiny in general? Do people pay attention to these forces and what they're doing?
In Indiana, I think there's been little in terms of school district police forces. I do think we have seen, you know, attention when city police have acted out. I mean, Indianapolis last year, there was an incident between an IMPD officer and a student that was caught on video outside of Shoreridge High School that drew a lot of attention. But in terms of the policing in the schools, you know, it really hasn't gotten a lot of attention, no.
And you mentioned in your story that some districts in other cities have ended their partnerships with local police departments. Are the reasons there the same reasons that IPS is considering this review?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, I think some of those cities that have already acted just in the past few weeks, I think they have had these conversations ongoing for a long time. There's been grassroots movements to kind of remove police from the schools. So that really has not happened here. We haven't really seen that in previous years, though. I mean, I have heard from some groups, you know, since my article was published, that say they are trying to talk to the district. They are families that have concerns, but it has not been to the level that we've seen in other cities, especially where entire school boards, you know, are in favor of doing that.
Do you know what some of those districts who are cutting ties with police departments, do you know what they're doing instead? I mean, is the idea for them to create their own kind of security force of some kind?
You know, I think the focus, you know, I think is kind of going away from security and is focusing more, you know, on having, you know, the counselors and people working with students versus having that extreme form of discipline that's brought in.
Yeah, because the idea is, I mean, it was brought about from, I'm sure, a number of different reasons, but school shootings, and not the least of which. And so is the idea there then to focus on mental health as a prevention for these kinds of incidents, as opposed to a focus on security to prevent these kinds of incidents, to kind of nip it in the bud, I guess, so to speak?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think people see, you know, that there's more wraparound services, holistic ways of kind of trying to work with students and deal with students before you bring in law enforcement. You know, though, I have spoken with some people in law enforcement, you know, that say, you know, I mean, a lot of people view schools as being very safe. You know, for one, there's not a lot of crime there. And two, you know, some schools do have, you know, armed police in them. You know, the issue of school shooting, you know, as we've seen in Indiana in the past few years, that's actually led to the increase of law enforcement in some school districts where they've passed tax-funded referenda to hire more officers to be inside the school buildings. So it's interesting that you're seeing, you know, some communities want more police, and you're then seeing other people, other communities in different types of school districts, which are kind of calling it into question.
You touched on some of the concerns that have been raised around that. I mean, is that a sort of a district to district kind of a thing where the concerns of one district may be, hey, there's not enough security. And then the concerns of another district may be, in the case of IPS, is saying, no, there's too much here. I don't know what's being said there.
Well, yeah, I mean, I definitely think, you know, it depends on the district. You know, I mean, we saw, you know, after the school shooting in Noblesville, you know, there was definitely a call for police officers to be at all the schools. You know, even, you know, IPS, which is, you know, one of the largest districts in the state, you know, they don't have officers in every school building. So I really think, you know, it depends on the school district, on the community, maybe, you know, how they actually view their relationship, you know, with the police. I'm sure a rural school district in Indiana is going to maybe view it differently than an urban district here in the state.
In your story, you report that the district's use of force policy was reviewed in April 2017. What is that policy, and did they say what they want reviewed about it?
Yeah, sure. So the use of force policy was the version that I was given. The document was created or effective in January of 2012, and then it was reviewed in 2017. And I don't know if anything was changed in 2017 other than it was just reviewed again and approved. But in general, you know, the document says department members shall not use more force in any situation than is reasonably necessary under the circumstances to effectively bring an incident under control or to overcome the resistance offered while being able to protect somebody else in the immediate area whose life may be in imminent peril. So, you know, just reading that, you know, it definitely seems to allow the officers to kind of respond as they believe they need to respond in that moment.
Well, that sounds an awful lot like what a number of protesters, including here in Indiana, are calling for as far as broad measures in police reform.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, here in Indianapolis, you know, we have seen, you know, the use of force policy by the Indianapolis Police Department, you know, has been a focus of the protests. You know, people want to see that changed and have it be more readily available. So definitely those kind of issues are, you know, I think what you're hearing more is people want more transparency from the department. You know, the IPS use of force policy, if it's available online, you know, it's not readily available. You know, I had the district send it to me so I could see it.
Has anything else about IPS's police force changed in recent years?
Yeah, I'd say there's two pretty big changes. One is the arrest of students. So there was a 68% drop in the number of arrests between 2014-15. That's the year that the report looked at, and last school year. So then, you know, that's a big drop. This past school year, when we saw COVID come in and school buildings shut down, just 50 students were arrested during that part of the school year. So it's a pretty big reduction from 5 or 6 years ago, when it was almost 240 students being arrested. The other big change is the number of officers in IPS has shrunk. So it's gone from about 56 officers and sergeants to 42 officers and sergeants and the current police chief. The police chief has also changed in the past year or two.
Are there any complaints about the district police force that come up a lot? What do people want changed, does it seem like?
I mean, I have not heard a complaint, you know, given to me in particular about the police force, though I have heard there are parents now that are asking the district to do a thorough and public review of the police department. You know, I think there's just a lot of interest in terms of who is being arrested, the race and age of the students who are being arrested by the police force. You know, I think those are areas people want to see publicly. The state publishes data on the police departments and the SROs in the state, and it includes basic information on arrest data, but it really doesn't go into school by school on that information.
You talked to a professor who studies policing in your story who explains that there are really no nationwide standards for integrating police into school districts. But he says that an important first step is for district leaders to decide why police are in the school to begin with. Do we know how IPS would answer that question? Do they even have an answer, does it seem?
Yeah, when I spoke with the police chief, you know, I asked that question, you know, and she basically said, you know, serve and protect is, you know, is one of the main reasons that they're there for, you know, but it's not the only role. You know, they say that they want to like foster relationships with students. They want to be mentors and they want to kind of have a role in lowering suspensions, you know, by getting to know students and helping them make better situations that maybe are going to get them out of circumstances that they shouldn't be in. And in my time, spending time in high schools at IPS, you know, I have seen those relationships between the police, as well as teachers and staff, of course. But I have seen police kind of trying to do that with students that they get to know and, you know, kind of try to guide them into the right decisions.
So knowing what you know, having reported on IPS specifically quite a bit and also education in central Indiana, knowing what you know about how quickly or maybe slowly things move, when can we expect to see, I guess, the bigger changes after a review of the police force at IPS?
Well, you know, I guess I would imagine it would take, you know, a few months just for any kind of review to be done. I mean, IPS has been doing different types of reviews in this, on the district, you know, whether it's buildings or so forth or facilities, you know, and those don't really happen quickly. But I think what we are seeing, though, right now is this moment with people calling for change, and things seem to be happening very quickly, you know, whether it's mayors responding or police departments responding, you know, to calls. So it wouldn't surprise me if the school district and the school board responds faster than normal. The professor that I did speak to at John Hopkins, you know, he has a concern about that. You know, he basically says, you know, he urges caution for people to make this big decisions right now until they have lots of data. But he also said, you know, data isn't everything. You know, you really need to like understand what role you want to have for the police in your school. You know, make sure everyone really realizes and thinks about it before they kind of make these decisions that could change everything.
Eric Weddle is an education reporter for our flagship station, WFYI in Indianapolis. Thanks so much for helping us unpack all this.
Sure thing, Matt. Thank you.
And you can find Eric's story and follow all of his local education coverage on WFYI.org. And he's on Twitter. Just search for Eric Weddle. He's the one that is not a professional football player. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.